Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Bush is weighing recommendations from Pentagon leaders and General Petraeus on further reductions of U.S. troops in Iraq and shifting forces to Afghanistan. Lawmakers in Pakistan are expected to elect People's Party leader and Bhutto widower Asif Ali Zardari president tomorrow, and Vice President Cheney traveled to Georgia and Ukraine to pledge U.S. support for the former Soviet republics. With me in the studio for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report. As always, I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Dimitri, I know you interviewed General Petraeus this week. What did he say about American combat troops and when they might be able to leave Baghdad?
Well, Dan, the interesting thing was I asked him about a security agreement being negotiated between the Americans and the Iraqis, which purportedly will see American combat troops leave Iraqi cities by mid-2009. And he said, well, actually, in 13 of the 18 provinces, they've already done that. And so what about Baghdad? Is it feasible to get out of Baghdad by that time? And he said, conditions permitting, it was. Now, he often says conditions permitting, but the fact that he was willing to raise the possibility that U.S. troops could leave Baghdad by that time was interesting. On the other hand, he this week made his recommendations to President Bush via the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for troop levels in Iraq. And he was more cautious. He wanted to keep roughly the same number of troops in Iraq until next summer. The Joint Chiefs and Secretary Robert Gates, the Defense Secretary, pushed back. And there's now kind of a compromise where some troops will come out in January. So I think he recognizes violence is down and it's possible U.S. troops will leave. On the other hand, he recognizes the political reality in the U.S. and also in Iraq.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou of Financial Times. Nancy Youssef, how much has security improved in Baghdad?
Well, you know, this debate really gets at that underlying question, how much have things really changed? I just got back from Iraq, and the security situation is certainly better. But residents there are still worried and anxious. They don't see how this is sustainable. There isn't a local Iraqi mechanism in place to keep these security gains going. And I think that's why you're hearing the hesitancy on the U.S. military side. I think everybody agrees that the situation's better, but nobody can see how this keeps going. And at the same time, you've got the Iraqi government prolonging the debate on when to have provincial elections, which will really decide a lot of these issues. So you've got Sunnis in the West who are saying, we want a legitimate role in the government. You've got the Sadrists weighing what kind of gains they can make in the political process. So when you're there, it feels like this is a holding pattern and that things will be decided after the provincial elections. And I think that's one of the reasons there's a discussion now about keeping troop levels where they are.
But what about Anbar Province, Kevin Whitelaw, the military handed over responsibility there?
To the Iraqis. And if you look at where we were 2 or 3 years ago, that really is a remarkable change of events. That really had been the most dangerous area, the toughest fighting, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq firmly ensconced in that province. And the fact that it has quieted down to that degree is interesting. Now, part of it is they've gone elsewhere, and you're looking at another province in Iraq, Diyala province, which remains incredibly problematic. The Al-Qaeda still has some pockets there. You still have a lot of violence and attacks going on there, a little quieter, a little more out of the way, but that's still happening. The larger point, I think, is just that the same factors that helped bring the violence down in the first place, a whole series of happenings that all coalesced around the same time, but to help allow the violence to go down. A lot of them can easily still be reversed. And I think whether you look at the Sunni decision to stop opposing the U.S. presence, at least temporarily, you look at the Shiite militias' decision to lay their arms down, or at least mostly lay their arms down. All of these things can be reversed on a dime, and I think that's the real problem. We still haven't seen the fundamental political shifts in there that sort of take us to a medium-term stability.
And this morning we hear of a new book by Bob Woodward talking about the surge of 2007, saying it was not the primary factor behind the drop in violence in the past 16 years. Talk about what was.
You know, I was there for part of it, and it's a really complex matrix. There's not one answer. I personally think it started in the fall of 2006 when the Sunnis rejected al-Qaeda, when they said the Sunnis aren't going to, that al-Qaeda is not going to defend us. They promised to defend us. We let them into our houses. We let them take over our neighborhoods, and they didn't defend us. And on top of that, they were killing our tribal leaders. And to me, that's the first domino that fell, if you will, and led to the security gains. And from there, the negotiations started, the violence dropped in Anbar. What the surge did is it sent a message to Iraqis. At this time, the American troops weren't leaving. They were going to be out in the neighborhoods. They were going to be conducting patrols and then staying. So that was one part of it. But to suggest that this is a debate about whether the surge worked or didn't work, I think is really oversimplistic.
I think the other interesting factor coming out in Bob Woodward's book was that there was an extensive spying operation going on, including Nouri al-Maliki.
I have to say, Diane, I also cover the intelligence agencies, that didn't surprise me as much. I assume that the Americans and most big national governments spy on other governments all the time. And I think if you remember Stephen Hadley, the national security advisor, I think it was last year, it may have been the year before, a memo that he had written castigating Maliki, saying he was incredibly weak, ineffectual, was leaked to one of the major US newspapers. And so clearly they've had a lot of concerns about Maliki. His health was a bit of an issue at one point, so they want to know what he's up to. So that didn't surprise me, but it won't go down very well with the Iraqis, obviously.
Well, you know, I mean, all along, the Iraqi leadership has been a pretty unreliable partner, but one that the United States cannot escape and needs to work with, very much with the way that, you know, made a big deal about handing sovereignty back to the Iraqis. It sort of got stuck with whatever was there, and so I think to the degree that they can try to anticipate and understand the kinds of pressures he's under and the splits inside that group, that at least, you know, in theory is going to help them to push him in the right direction.
Then the question becomes, how big a troop buildup are we looking at for Afghanistan, Nancy Youssef?
Well, it's now all tied to Iraq. How quickly can the U.S. withdraw troops from Iraq and then send them to Afghanistan? My sense in the Pentagon is that this is kind of becoming a growing debate, because send more troops to Afghanistan to do what? What is the mission? How do they operate? I think there's a danger that people assign to Iraq and Afghanistan that one sort of strategy that applies to Iraq can apply to Afghanistan. It's very different. The terrain is different. The tribal system is different. The organization is different in terms of the relationship of U.S. vis-a-vis foreign
so
troops.
So what do you see the U.S. hoping to accomplish there, Dimitri?
Well, I mean, I think Nancy is right. I mean, one of the big questions with Afghanistan, and this is one of the things Petraeus said to me in the interview, I asked him whether there needed to be a bigger surge in Afghanistan, is that in Afghanistan, what the U.S. and the international countries are doing is construction. It's not reconstruction. Afghan doesn't have the education base, the infrastructure base that Iraq had. And so aside from all of the militancy, you've got huge problems there, and it's going to be a very, very, very long-term commitment that involves billions of dollars building roads, building schools, building hospitals, and building the Iraqi population up so that they can develop their own security forces and develop their own politics in a way that's sustainable in the long run. And that is not just a military solution. It's much more complicated than Iraq.
So is it your understanding that President Bush is currently weighing all these recommendations at Camp David, that we're likely to hear about this decision in a few days?
Well, I think if General Petraeus had openly disagreed or told the president he disagreed with what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Secretary Gates were recommending, the president might have gone with General Petraeus. He's very close to him. He calls him Dave. But it seems that General Petraeus basically agreed to a kind of a compromise that Secretary Gates and Avril Mullen this week presented to President Bush. So I suspect he will accept those recommendations.
How soon might we hear an announcement, Kevin?
I think it could be in the next week or so.
I think we're
expecting this to come down relatively soon, although, it might be a little while before the details really get shaken out, because obviously they're still trying to calibrate the message.
Exactly.
He's also got to be, there's perhaps some political considerations as well with the McCain campaign and trying to make sure he doesn't end up undercutting anything that's going on there.
Well, next week, Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates will be testifying on Capitol Hill about this very issue. On Wednesday, we expect at least some kind of statement from the president about where he sees things going. What's interesting is this recommendation won't be from General Petraeus, and I personally think one of the reasons is they don't want the general to be thrown into the political debate. And by having him testify so close to the election, it might make his testimony a lot more political than it would have been 6 months ago when he last testified.
So who will testify?
Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen will be on Capitol Hill for, I think, on Wednesday morning before the House, and they will be asked about this, and I suspect that they will give detail about what exactly they recommended to the president.
So would you agree with Kevin that we're likely to hear in the next day? Few days?
I think by the end of next week, we will know what President Bush has decided to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to take just a short break here. Dimitri Sevastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for Financial Times. Nancy Youssef is Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy News. Kevin Whitelaw is deputy assistant managing editor of U.S. News and World Report. We'll take a short break and be back. We'll take your questions, comments. Do join us. And we're back with the international portion of our Friday News Roundup. We were talking about the troop withdrawal from Iraq just before the break. On Monday, U.S. forces apparently mistakenly killed 6 members of the Iraqi security force. How did this happen, and what impact is it going to have?
Well, we have seen incidents like this, unfortunately, all throughout. I mean, there's been a very difficult time coordinating what they call friendly force identification in Iraq and as well as Afghanistan. We've seen incidents like this.
Why is that so hard?
Well, I think because, especially in Iraq, there are so many different forces. The command structure is so fragmented, and they just don't have the same kinds of communications and structures that the U.S. military has. Keep in mind as well, we've seen, especially in active combat situations where friendly fire happens between U.S. forces, U.S. forces on U.S. forces. So, people talk about the fog of war for a reason. You do see these incidents. This particular one appears to have started when these Iraqi forces fired upon U.S. Forces, perhaps mistaking them for something else. Little unclear as to exactly then, how you prevent each of these episodes. But when you have all these different forces under all sorts of different levers of control in different places.
And more killings, even this morning, mistaken killings in Afghanistan, Nancy.
That's right. There was a missile attack this morning, and reports are 7 civilians dead, according to the local population there. I wanted to go back to Kevin's point, if I could. I think the other compounding factor is, and I saw this when I was in Iraq, there's a point of transition now where the Iraqis are more in the lead, the U.S. forces are more behind, and I think that's contributing to the confusion, that it's unclear who's in charge, what units are where. It's not just one uniform anymore. You have Iraqi forces who think they're in the lead, and maybe U.S. forces are nearby, and I think that's contributing to the confusion. I know I saw that in Iraq all the time, where the U.S. forces are trying to let the Iraqis take the lead, but very suddenly there are circumstances where they have to come back in the lead, and I think that contributes to the confusion.
I would just add that as the Iraqi forces become more capable and start to take the lead in these different kind of operations, they need to move into a new phase of training, which is training on how you work with each other and how you prevent friendly fire and things like that. When you're not in combat situations, it's very difficult to train for that.
Well, you know, and you asked about Afghanistan. I think, you know, in some ways, some of what we've seen in Afghanistan is a slightly different situation. And this, in part, actually comes back to what we were talking about earlier with the troop level question, which is, given that there are fewer U.S. troops available, there's been a higher reliance and a much higher demand for airstrikes and for using air power, whether from planes, but also particularly from unmanned planes. And we're seeing a lot of these kinds of missile strikes in these very, very remote, hard-to-get-to areas of Afghanistan. So when you're trying to manage it from you know, thousands of feet in the air, these planes often being flown from bases, if not in Afghanistan, sometimes in the United States, it really does allow for a lot of questions about exactly who you've ended up hitting. And that's what we saw with this incident, where the Afghans claimed that 90 people were killed, 90 civilians were killed, 60 of them being children.
Right.
The U.S. came back and said, no, we think it's 30, 35 Taliban fighters and only 5 to 7 civilians. I don't think we're ever going to know exactly what happened, but part of the problem is this happened as part of an airstrike, and very hard to go back and piece together who they thought they were getting and who they actually ended up hitting.
Dmitry, let's talk about Russia and Georgia. Vice President Cheney has made the trip to Georgia. Today, he's in Ukraine. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev this week suggested that the U.S. instigated the war in Georgia to bolster John McCain's campaign. What do you think about those kinds of statements?
I think the Russians haven't put forward any evidence to back up those kind of allegations. Medvedev and Prime Minister now Putin have launched a very vigorous public relations campaign to try and defend themselves after the war with Georgia. Which,
what would they be pointing to?
Well, the U.S. has trained Georgian forces in Georgia for different reasons, partly for the forces who went to Iraq. They have provided training for forces that were at some point supposed to go to Afghanistan. And so and the U.S. trains a lot of different forces around the world. That doesn't mean that they're being trained specifically for an attack that's going to provoke a war with Russia. And Russia also accused an American, I forget his name, I think his last name was White, who's now an English teacher in China, of being a CIA operative who was trying to help the Georgians because they found a passport that he had lost 2 years ago. So there have been a lot of wild claims being bandied around, but very little evidence so far.
So how have the Russians reacted to the flagship of the U.S. Navy's Mediterranean fleet anchored just outside a key Georgian port, presumably to deliver food and medicine? Nancy.
Angrily, they've said that this is sort of a provocation, and I think it's been a very interesting politic happening on the Russian side, if you will. You know, all of these events this week, the $1 billion of aid promised by the U.S., Cheney's call for Georgia to be a member of NATO, his visit to Georgia, are all, I think, reflecting the U.S.'s ambivalence about what it should do, what it can do in Georgia. And to me, the decision to suggest that Georgia be a member of NATO was one sort of the least that they could do, and in a way the most dangerous, because we are essentially promising to defend a country that we cannot defend. So I think,
unless we're willing to go to war with Russia.
Yeah, the Pentagon would not embrace that. I mean,
exactly.
how many battles and over what? And is this over oil? I mean, what become the reason? So I thought it was a lot of interesting developments. But both sides are playing a very dangerous game.
I do find this really remarkable. I mean, it obviously has gotten caught up in the political context here in the United States. Both campaigns obviously talking about it, trying to sound tough and defending poor little Georgia, and leave aside the question of you know, McCain's ties to Georgia with one of his chief advisors being a long-time lobbyist for Georgia. We'll leave that aside. You do look at a situation where we are talking about perhaps restarting a Cold War over Georgia. And you're seeing some very strong arguments saying we need to stand up to the Russians here in this situation so that they don't think they can start to get, you know, they don't learn that they can get away with these things in the future. But the decision to send Vice President Cheney, not perhaps known for his diplomatic skills that much, to Georgia at this time, I think is an interesting signal to Russia.
I think it's important, Diane, to point out that Cheney's visit was actually scheduled before the war even broke out. And Cheney has made a kind of a cause of going to some of the Soviet republics, to cement support for them. He's been very strong on that, as has McCain. I think the broader issue is, if you look since the fall of the Soviet Union, the US has been involved in this kind of tug of war with Russia over the former republics to try and bring them into the US sphere of control via NATO. The US would like to get Ukraine into NATO, would like to see Georgia in NATO. They want to do it in a way that will avoid a confrontation with Russia, but that's where they want to get at the end of the day.
You're all talking about the implications of everything that's happening there in Georgia, and indeed around the world, the implications for Senator McCain, Senator Obama, in terms of this election. Here's an email from Chris, who says, does your panel feel Governor Palin has the necessary skills and knowledge to handle these very complex foreign affairs? A concern of mine, as with many other Americans, is that she doesn't have near enough experience, particularly given the fact she's only been out of the country once in her life. Nancy Youssef.
Well, I'll leave it to voters to decide if she has enough experience, but whoever comes in next is going to have to, at the minimum, come up with a strategy, a policy. How much are we going to do engagement? What is our strategy going to be in Iraq? How are we going to shift in Afghanistan? I don't know what experience it takes to have that kind of judgment and ability to come up with the kind of policies that will lead to the best interests of the U.S., but that's what lies ahead. I think in terms of talking about experience, for me as someone who watches it, I'm curious what kind of doctrine will come out of the next administration. Mm. We've seen in this administration the power of the vice president, so we certainly can't underestimate what her role could be in the next administration. But moving forward, I think whoever comes in is going to have to come up with a doctrine that deals with these very issues. How often are we going to be unilateral? How often are we going to reach out to other countries?
Dimitri.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, some people would say that she has more executive experience than both Senator McCain and Obama and Senator Biden, who is the VP candidate for Senator Obama. She could probably use the argument that Senator Obama himself has used, which is that it's wisdom and how you make a decision that's more important than how much you know and the people you have around you. She could argue that if she has good people around her, she can make a wise decision. On the other hand, McCain is quite old. If something happened to him and she was cast into the presidency very early on, the fact that she knows very little about foreign affairs, even if she has a little bit more executive experience, is probably worrying to some of her critics.
Well, and I think as we go forward, we're going to see a very interesting debate when she goes up against the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Biden. Obviously, it's going to be, they're going to want to try, the Democrats are going to want to try to point out some of her lack of knowledge. And you can imagine she'll be studying up quite a lot in the coming weeks to get ready for that.
Here's an email from Dito in Little Rock, Arkansas. Since Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice established her academic credentials by specializing in the Cold War relationships between Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, how would you rate her handling of the Georgia crisis, Dmitry?
That's a good question. I mean, I have to say that even before the Georgia conflict with Russia occurred, critics of hers said that despite the fact that her background was primarily in the Soviet Union, that she had not done a very good job of managing the U.S. relationship with Russia. You remember, during the 90s, Russia had been quite weak. It's resurged with the oil money and the energy money that it's getting. And last year in Munich, President Putin launched this very strong attack on the U.S. And since then, relations have really deteriorated. And a lot of people have said that Condi Rice, despite her background, has not really managed that very well. So I think overall, her record has probably not been great.
Well, I think the other thing here is this crisis didn't spring out of nowhere, and there had been signs that had been building. The United States had been warned, you know, and it dates back to the recognition of Kosovo, which originally the Russians had been very clear about with the United States, saying this was a red line for us. If you do this, we're going to move into our near abroad. This is not, again, happening in a vacuum. And so I think to the degree that you see all those warning signs out there, you see explicit warnings, you see implicit warnings, along with the emergence of a clearly more nationalistic Russian government in the past couple of years, you know, I think there is a bit of a question as to where the judgment was, where the recognition was of what was going on here, and whether there was any attempt made to head off these kinds of things.
You know, it's interesting. In the run-up to this, there was talk that the U.S. was trying to discourage Saakashvili from launching this attack and wasn't able to do so. And one could argue that that's the ultimate measure of U.S. diplomacy in that region. Georgia is an ally of the U.S., a strong ally of the U.S., and yet they couldn't stop the first domino from falling that triggered all these events.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kevin, Pakistani lawmakers are going to elect a new president tomorrow. Will Asif Ali Zardari, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, be a shoo-in?
Well, I mean, he's there by default at this point. He probably has the votes. He probably has, you know, certainly more votes than any of the other candidates running, but he's not exactly a popular choice. Obviously, becoming a more and more controversial choice, not simply because of his history of being associated with corruption. He still has never escaped the nickname Mr. 10% for a whole set of corruption allegations that have haunted him for a number of years. But also, you know, he's under his leadership, we've watched this former coalition government dissolve, and the partnership with the other former prime minister Nawaz Sharif sort of fall apart. And so you're looking at a very difficult situation, a continued fractured Pakistani politics moving ahead. Not to mention the very uncomfortable allegations that came out a couple weeks ago of some psychiatric reports on on Pakistan's apparent next president that were rather unflattering.
What about relations between him and the current U.S. administration?
Well, the U.S. is sort of reluctantly endorsing this, and that they see him as a potential ally, the best of options available, if you want. It's interesting, though, the attack that happened this week, the special forces moving into Pakistan, in a way kind of disregarded domestic politics and put someone who's seen as a potential U.S. ally in a very precarious position. Remember, the U.S., the word United States in Pakistan is radioactive, and to have suggestions that Pakistani civilians were killed by U.S. forces didn't really help his campaign.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Diane, the situation in Pakistan is always very difficult to read. There's so many different players right now. Even people within Pakistan often don't know what's going on. And it's not clear to me that the Pakistanis may have been aware that an attack like this was coming, that there would be attacks like this. Mm. But there may have been a kind of a quiet agreement, whereas when it happens, they will protest in very loud terms, but actually may have known that these kind of things were starting to happen. And Admiral Mullen, again, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, last week met with General Kiani, the head of the Pakistani army, on the USS Lincoln, and other senior US and Pakistani military figures for a big meeting. We don't have a lot of detail about what they discussed, but it's possible that they talked about things like this.
And let's finally talk about North Korea. Diplomats are heading for Beijing to try to deal with the notion that North Korea is redeveloping its nuclear weapons.
That's right. The South Koreans have claimed that, the North Koreans are trying to restart the, and rebuild at the Yongbyon nuclear facility, the one that, they so dramatically blew up the cooling tower of not that long ago. You know, I think, you know, for anyone who's watched North Korea, this doesn't really come as a surprise. The North Koreans are just incredibly hard bargainers. Every little thing gets fought over, gets turned around.
What do they want? They want to be taken off.
They want to be taken off the U.S. terrorism list.
Exactly.
and the state sponsor list. And they've been asking for that for a long time. The U.S. says we still have not yet agreed to a comprehensive verification procedure, inspections, surprise inspections of your various facilities, which was, for us, the precondition for this happening.
Nancy.
One could argue one of the other things they want is to not have as many verification steps they have to take for the U.S., that this is a bargaining tactic, not only for this administration, which has a long list, but maybe for the next one.
The key sticking point, Diane, is the U.S. wants to have a credible verification regime. They would like to have some kind of spot, snap inspections. The North Koreans are worried that U.S. intelligence agents will be running around the country inspecting other things, and it's trying to get a compromise there that's a sticking point.
Dmitry Sevastopolo of Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, Kevin Whitelaw of U.S. News and World Report. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing with you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Shield, the popular and award-winning FX drama about a rogue cop, just began its seventh and final season. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with two of the show's stars, Michael Chiklis and CCH Pounder. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back. It's time to open the phones first to Bruce, who's in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking the call, Diane.
Sure.
Something that I pondered through this whole situation, I've wondered for a long time now why, with the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia has chosen to remain with such an adversarial stance. You know, the metaphor of flies and honey. If an invitation were extended for Russia to join the European Union and NATO and have everything balance out in terms of proper economics and the trade, have they just decided to remain where they are because the authoritarian, they want to embrace the capitalism, but they do want to sacrifice the things that will come with that?
I think Russia resented the 90s and being told that it was weak, that it was incapable of coming back. And I think this is, for lack of a better term, ego, that they want to show the world community that they are a force to be reckoned with, that they've rebuilt them their nation up. I mean, when you go to Moscow, it changes every 6 months in terms of the development and the evolution. And I think ultimately they want to send a message that they matter.
Here's an email from Suzanne. Please explain why the U.S. would be giving $1 billion in aid to Georgia while I barely heard a word regarding the hundreds of thousands of people in India displaced, hungry, and dying because of monsoon flooding. Dimitri.
I think it's A, they want to send a very strong message to Russia that you cannot mess with the former Soviet republics on your borders that want to have friendly relations with the West. And if you try and do anything, we will come back with huge amounts of money and we are there to support them.
But where's the money going, Dimitri?
The money, we've been told, is about $1 billion was announced this week.
Right.
In comparison, last year the U.S. gave, I think it was $60-odd million to Georgia. They've given $1.8 billion since Georgia gained its independence again in 1991.
And where is that money
going? It supposedly is going to go for humanitarian relief, for aid, for reconstruction assistance. And at the moment, we are told that it's not being programmed or will not be programmed for military training and support.
Nancy.
And that's the most interesting part, because the U.S. was boasting before all this of its training of the Georgian forces, as Dimitri mentioned, not only for Iraq, but for their own missions. And I think, frankly, to put it crudely, I think the question comes up. It didn't go so well, the training, the first time. So I think this is another effort to get at it.
All right. To South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Bobby Lee.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, panel. My question is based on an interview that was done by Deborah Solomon, the Sunday New York Times magazine last month. She interviewed Dennis Kucinich. I probably said that wrong.
No, you didn't.
Okay, and she's talking to him about his determination to go forward with the impeachment of the president and the vice president. And her question, the question that I'm concerned with is, she says, "But why bother with impeachment when Bush is on his way out of Washington anyhow? And he says, the congressman says, this president is capable of taking us into war in October on the eve of an election to try to change the outcome of the election. We need to keep the ability to impeach at the ready in the event that this president continues to exercise a wanton approach toward the use of power, particularly the war power. The events in Georgia are a premonition." Is he, you know, out to lunch, or is he on target with his prediction about President Bush's power?
Nancy.
Well, it's interesting that she mentions that, because there was a talk, there was talk a few months ago about possibly striking Iran, and that this would be something that would be done in the last few months of the administration. And what we saw was that a lot of people, what we heard anyway, is that a lot of people intervened and said, we can't do it. So I think there was a concern about that more so a few months ago, but a feeling now that any sort of push to sort of leave a last message to the world community that other powers will placate that.
All right. To Franklin, Connecticut. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Diane. The McCain campaign has attempted to frame this campaign around John McCain's experience and whether or not Obama's experience prepares him to not to be trusted with the presidency. I think that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld have shown us that experience alone is not the best measure, and or whether or not, you know, the administration will serve the country well. And there are four specific instances which your panelists have touched on today that I think Barack Obama has shown over the campaign where his judgment has been better than John McCain's, and specifically about striking suspected terrorist outposts over the Pakistani border. I think they lampooned him during the debates about whether or not that was a good judgment. Also, with the surge, and now with the book by Bob Woodward, we're learning more about really the details. And I think Nancy Youssef said earlier that it really started much sooner than the surge. And I think one of the other panelists said that it could turn on a dime. So if the surge was really so successful, it shouldn't be able to turn on a dime if the surge was the real cause. I think as well with the Georgia situation, John McCain came right out without really evaluating the whole situation and spoke for the country as a senator, saying we all are Georgians. And Barack Obama took a more measured approach there. And then with Afghanistan, Barack Obama had spoken months and months before John McCain adopted the policy of we need to send more brigades to take care of Afghanistan. And I just think the real question is judgment.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dimitri.
Diane, well, the caller sounds like he may be voting for Barack Obama in November. And essentially what the line he's just espoused is what Barack Obama says, which is that Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were two of the most experienced men in Washington. They had been around for decades. And look what's happened in Iraq. And that's the criticism. I don't think anyone would disagree that experience is a good thing. The question is, you have to have experience with judgment. And if you have someone who's got a lot of experience in poor judgment, that's not necessarily going to be a good combination. It remains to be seen.
Well, you know, and I think the other thing that watching Georgia, the crisis evolve, you know, it really does bring up these echoes of the Cold War. And I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see, to the degree that this becomes and continues to be a campaign issue, does that difference between a candidate who came to his political life in the middle of the Cold War, whose experiences in that world and in the world of foreign policy were forged in the Cold War, versus one who really came into his own in political life after the end of the Cold War. Very interesting to see when those two candidates really start engaging on these issues, whether that brings out some interesting differences in approach and how Americans react to that.
You know, one other thing we did not mention in regard to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who becomes the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit our former enemy, Libya, since 1953, Dimitri.
Well, this was a very significant development. The Clinton administration paved the way for this. They started to hold negotiations with Libya to renounce and abandon their weapons of mass destruction. That actually happened a couple of years ago. And as a result of that, the U.S. has normalized relations with Libya. And the U.S., Condi Rice is now saying to the world, look what Libya did, look what they're getting in return. North Korea, Iran, here's a good example, you should follow this. It's been very interesting to watch.
And yet it's a complicated situation in that while the relations between the governments is better, there's still a real friction and uprise within the people. Some of the Libya has been one of the biggest places where insurgents have come in to go into Iraq. It's been a place where insurgencies have turned to find fighters and suicide bombers.
All right, to John, who is calling us from Moscow. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane, can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can, John.
Yeah, I listen to your show a lot, so thanks for it, I guess. I have a question about Dick Cheney's recent remarks about Georgia. And he quite regularly takes a hard tone on Russia. But I was wondering, I think what was the purpose of his remarks? Because I think Dick Cheney obviously has a very low standing in the world. And I would have thought there'd be somebody with a bit more credibility who could have made a harsh statement.
Dimitri.
I would just say that John McCain has been going to that region Dick Cheney has been going to that region for a number of years, making similar kind of harsh statements. This trip was planned before the war. I'm not surprised that he made it. He's the one the Bush administration sends to make tough rhetoric on Russia in the region.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Diane, but this is also one of those areas where this has been one of the central parts of the Bush administration's theme throughout, which is democracy and democracy promotion. And the Georgia fits squarely into the middle of that as a little democracy going up against a big, bad, autocratic Russia. And that fits into this theme all throughout.
All right. To Savannah, Georgia. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'm just making a comment. About the Bush and the president of Russia continue to use these tough guy stances, I wonder where it's all leading. And in the last election, I think Bush swayed the evangelical vote. And in this one, Palin is, I think, going to try to sway the evangelical, the women, and the oil vote. And that's just my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Good question. Where is this confrontation leading? Has it really reached a point beyond confrontation, beyond talk? Or is there something else going on, Dmitry?
Well, one of the key levers over Russia is the European Union. It's a big trading partner as a bloc with Russia. On the other hand, it depends heavily on Russian energy, natural gas and other things. And it's been interesting. The Europeans over the last couple of weeks have talked about imposing sanctions on Russia because of the conflict in Georgia, and yet they haven't been able to agree to it. John McCain in the US has suggested that Russia be kicked out of the G8, the group of eight powerful countries that essentially kind of run these international meetings. The Europeans would mostly be against that as well. So it's a difficult one. That Russia is a strong country and it's got a lot of money in its coffers right now. And aside from going to war, there aren't a lot of levers that the US and Europe has with it.
We have an email from Michael who says, it seems to me the Bush administration has good reason to build up Russia as a military partner since Georgia is very close to Iran, and Georgia would make a good staging area since flights could be routed over the Caspian Sea. Kevin.
Well, you know, look, you've got a whole set of considerations. I'd actually say the thing you really need to look at is the Crimea and Ukraine, right? This is another area of the near abroad that Russia has said that it has interests in. It's got a key naval port. It's got a lot of other things that it values very much in the same way that it looks at the regions in Georgia. So you've got to look at a whole set of these kinds of questions all throughout the borders. But that would be the next place to watch to see if something happens.
You know, the listener raises an interesting point, I think, and one that's being debated in the military, which is, you know, the U.S. military has been so focused on counterinsurgency fighting. And what this conflict reminded the military was, wait a minute, we might have to go to more conventional means of warfare very quickly, very suddenly. And you started to see this debate happening within military circles about that balance between fighting a counterinsurgency and fighting a conventional war.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Jason.
Hello, Diane. Wonderful program. Pleasure to be on your show. Thank you. I had a question. This may have been addressed a little bit. The United Nations, NATO, Georgia is just calling on the U.S. to come in and help out. The international community, I mean, we're across the other side of the world. Why is there no intervention amongst those people who are so closely related to all of the things that are going on?
Kevin.
That's basically the reason, actually, is they're too closely related to the things going on. They depend on energy supplies from Russia, and Russia has shown a willingness in the past to cut off natural gas and other supplies to parts of Europe and Eastern Europe. So it's very much the reason. And the U.S. has always been one of the strongest rhetorical backers of Georgia, and it's a long relationship going back to its birth.
And here's an email from Fred in Newbury, Ohio, who says, I'm worried about bringing Georgia into NATO. This is a calculated risk, which might be a tragic miscalculation. World War I came about largely because of entangling alliances among nations. Are we not setting ourselves up for something similar? Military conflict with Russia is avoidable if we respect their security needs. Nancy.
You know, Fred is exactly right when he calls it a calculated risk. It is exactly that. It's a calculated risk. And if you let in Georgia, do you then have to let in Ukraine? Where is the line? At what point does the U.S. intervene? And with whom? Is it become a unilateral move on the U.S.'s part, potentially? Or is this something that the world community would be involved in? I think he's right. It's a calculated risk. And as I said earlier, it's a dangerous game, and I think the U.S. is going down this road because it doesn't have any other options.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, the U.S. wants to draw the former Soviet countries into a pro-Western sphere of influence, and NATO is one way to do it. It's a defensive alliance, and the alliance has actually emerged over years. There are now partnerships with countries in Asia. Russia's concern is that there was an agreement after the Cold War that NATO would not expand to the east, and that it looks like it's doing that now, and that this is on their borders. And so they're concerned about that, and I think you can say understandably from their perspective.
So how might the next administration handle this, Kevin?
Well, I think they're going to have a very tough choice. I mean, the real question is, has this Georgian crisis effectively ended the eastward expansion of NATO or not? And I think the point that Fred's raising here is NATO membership comes with treaty obligations. And so, you know, by the terms of this, the U.S. and the rest of the NATO members would be obligated to defend Georgia had it been a member of NATO when Russia went in. And so I think they're going to have to look at all of these questions and look at the larger relationship with Russia, which is Georgia really the most important, you know, question in U.S.-Russian relations? We've needed Russia on a whole set of other diplomatic situations, whether it involves Iran, whether it involves North Korea, whether it involves Iraq, or energy, or a whole host of other things. And so at some point, it comes to a question of how do you balance all of these competing interests and sort of get down to what are the core American interests in the U.S. relationship with Russia?
And by the way, the AP is now reporting from the White House that President Bush will make his announcement on new troop levels in Iraq next week. Thank you all so much. Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon intelligence correspondent for Financial Times. Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin Whitelaw, Deputy Assistant Managing Editor for U.S. News and World Report. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Have a good weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.